Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from the University of Central Florida, where educators and innovators are partnering to build a bold future for Florida and beyond. From medical research to advances in space travel, UCF students, faculty, and researchers are helping to build the future. More information is at goforlaunch.ucf.edu.
Artemis II flies by the moon, and a look at NASA's budget proposal. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. For the first time in over 50 years, the Artemis II mission brought humans back to the moon. During their lunar flyby, the crew saw the moon in a way that was never observed by humans and made observations about the lunar surface that will be crucial for the future of the Artemis program and our understanding of our moon. Planetary scientists Addie Dove and Paul Byrne joined the show to talk about these observations and the future of lunar understanding. Then NASA is once again facing a significant budget cut from the White House. The proposal cuts 23% of the space agency's funding. We'll speak with the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer about these potential cuts and what it means for the future of NASA and programs like Artemis. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? On Monday, the crew of four aboard the Orion spacecraft flew around the moon, making observations and taking photos of the lunar far side from a perspective never before seen by human eyes. It's a mission of many firsts, and the crew continues to send back data and photos of our moon. Taking thousands of photos, the crew members worked together to collect these new and exciting images and describe just what they saw. The images are more than just really cool pictures. They are key pieces of data to help us better understand what the moon is made of and where it comes from. Here to talk more about Artemis and the mission is Addie Dove, a planetary scientist and professor of physics at the University of Central Florida, and Paul Byrne, associate professor of Earth, Environmental, and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. And just to note, we recorded this conversation Tuesday afternoon as images were still flowing in. Addie, Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
Great to be here.
So we've got some very, very exciting images have been coming down from the Orion space capsule from their flyby on Monday. Addie, I want to start with you. What's been your reaction to these photos?
I have just been geeking out. When I got up this morning, I was like, have they put them up yet? And they hadn't. And then when they came out, I've just been gasping. I think watching it yesterday live and seeing the images, just even from the potato camera on the GoPro on the solar wing that they've like downgraded the resolution and stuff. It's just been so phenomenal to see all of this and see it progressing. And then to see these high resolution images that they've sent back, they're just so stunning.
Mm-hmm. Paul?
It's flabbergasting. So I watched the flyby live yesterday evening, and just exactly saying, we saw this sort of, you know, potato quality, you know, highly compressed images from GoPros on the solar wings, which in and of itself is a conversation. But we knew that, you know, they have these really good, well, they have iPhones and they also have this Nikon, you know, this DSLR. And so I was just like, Addie, just refreshing that page this morning, waiting for those pictures. Because when we were hearing them describe what they were seeing, which is part of the science, right? They ran out of superlatives to describe what they were seeing. And I can't remember who said it. One of the crew members said where it's the effect of humans did not evolve to see this kind of thing. You know, so I posted one of these this morning and I quoted the line from the film Contact, where the main character is traveling and she's like, you know, there are no words, it should have said a poet. And I think it just captures the fact that this is so much more than just science and technology. There's something very humane about the fact that we're sending humans out into this part of space for the first time and asking them to report back to their entire species what they're seeing.
They could have sent a journalist too. You know, I'm pretty good with words.
They might, right? Because literally, and no kidding, like the whole goal of this Artemis is that it be a sustained thing we do. So you never know.
Addie, Paul mentioned that they were talking about what they were seeing, and that is almost as important, if not more important, than the images, right? I mean, just explain what this kind of, you know, verbal description of what they saw, how that is going to help scientists like yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's remarkable to just be able to follow along with them as it's happening, like the fact that we had live stream video and audio of them as this was all happening, and getting to hear the excitement in their voice and the fascination in their voices. And they trained a ton for this, right? And they were trained, I've talked with other folks, and they were remarking at how, even though sometimes they were having trouble finding the words, they were so precise and observing all these different things. And they're not necessarily geologists or anything like that, right? But they were well-trained, and they're also good observers, and they're very detailed. So these are people who can describe what they're seeing, and it's always important in situations like this to be able to describe what's happening. And so to have them doing those descriptions and just sharing it with us, and sort of in a way where it's like people that haven't been looking at the moon necessarily, like some of us have for a long time, and just to hear the awe and the how remarkable they thought the texture on the surface was and the topography and how 3D everything was. Like some of those descriptions were just so exciting to hear.
Paul, how did they do from a planetary science perspective? How were those descriptions?
They were fantastic. And it's just like Addy says, when we train students, we tell them, you know, you can take all the photos you want, but a really important part of any kind of field-based exercise of any kind is to also narrate what you see, which we would usually have students write stuff in their journals or notebooks and sketch what they see, because the image may capture the whole thing and there'll be sort of like as objective a view as you might get, but it's people's impressions of what they see. And it's also the fact that the eye is such an amazingly sensitive instrument, much more than any camera we have. They did a fantastic job. And exactly like Ali said, these folks were trained well. And we know that that kind of training will underpin what happens for subsequent Artemis crews as well, especially those crews that will get onto the lunar surface, because there are going to be things they will see that we can't even necessarily anticipate. And so the point is to help equip them with the resources, the tools they need to be able to recognize something and describe it, so that we have all the time in the world later after the fact to go back through all those images and those notes and those audio tracks. But it's the real-time discovery they're doing which helps us be there with them. I will say, hugely helped by the folks in the science back room at Mission Control, and we have folks on console in Mission Control who are scientists as well. That marrying of the kind of exploration engineering side of things and the science side of things is not something we saw to the same extent in Apollo, but it undergirds much of what's happening in Artemis, and it's a really positive thing to see.
Paul, is this kind of a turning point for our understanding of the moon at this point?
I think it is in two ways, right? So first off, anytime we go and we send humans, we're going to see new things. So for example, the astronauts reported seeing at least four impact flashes from micrometeoroids smacking into the lunar surface at, you know, several kilometers per second in the relatively short period of time they were on the then dark side of the moon. In the duration of the eclipse, they saw these things, and we have these long running, often citizen science exercises on Earth where we have telescopes pointed at the moon to try and identify these impact flashes, because it tells us all kinds of things about the population of impactors that's out there, the potential risk that a lunar base might face, things like that. But the astronauts were able to see at least four of these in 54 minutes. That's astonishing. So not only are we learning new things about the moon and the sun, right? We're seeing structures in the sun's corona as it was occluded by the moon, but we're also learning how to do lunar and deep space science. And that's the thing too, right? Because this is not Apollo, we hope, where it's boots on the ground, flag in the soil, and then they go home. This is to going to the moon to stay and using that as figuratively, literally a base for future missions for farther distances and destinations in the solar system, including Mars. And so we are learning how to combine science and engineering and technology and management and public relations. And Artemis 2 is just the start. And I've seen people on social media comment that this is like watching a show they love and they're bummed that it's going to end on Friday and we're going to have to wait at least a year for the next season, right? Artemis 3, which is going to hopefully fly in 27. The amount of the strong positive response to these flybys and these images that I think I've seen just generally from folks who are not normally space dorks like we are is extremely encouraging. And I think that's hopefully going to be an extra kind of impetus that NASA will need to demonstrate to Congress that this really is something that's worth investing over the long term so we can continue these missions out into the future.
It certainly warms my heart, Paul, that you have included me in the space dork realm.
You are 100% one of our space dorks.
100%.
Yeah.
You're listening to Are We There Yet on Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Addy Dove and Paul Byrne. They're both planetary scientists. We're talking about the science from the lunar flyby of Artemis 2. Addy, Paul mentioned kind of the public relations of this whole thing, people following along. Is there a particular image that... and I will say we are taping this on Tuesday afternoon, but is there a particular image that has dropped so far that is just really astounding to you?
There's like the lunar flyby package that they've released so far. And that has a bunch of Earth rise or Earth set images that are just so breathtaking. And I think that the perspective that they have in those and a bunch of the different ones is just so phenomenal. The solar eclipse image, though, with the moon backlit by this ethereal light just is so ridiculous. It's just like I don't know. It's just ridiculous. It's something that that looks unreal, literally, but it's this phenomenal image that if they'd launched in March, they wouldn't have gotten to get that image, right? Just the fact that they were able to see it. And Paul mentioned earlier the way they were describing it. It was such a dynamic observation while they were there too. Just thinking about that and thinking about what we'll be able to get from those images is so cool. And then I also thought it was super fun during the eclipse. They saw some planets in the sky and they could see stars and some planets in the sky. All of those were great. There's a bunch of really cool shots of them taking the images. So them in the capsule doing the observations. We don't have a lot of those because it was really dark in the capsule. So I think they limited how many of those they took, but some of them are just super cool.
Paul, she may have stole all your thunder there, but is there anything that Addie didn't mention that stands out to you?
No, but I'm going to riff on two things that she said. One, there's a really cool photo of the four of them wearing their solar eclipse glasses. It's a great photo. And that photo that Addie talked about, the backlit moon, there's a little bit of earth shine on part of it actually from the earth, which is off the view. And of course, in one of these pictures, there's a very, very bright thing in the lower left, which is Venus, because there's never an opportunity I won't take to talk about Venus.
Addie, I want to turn it back to the science. This is cool for folks like me, but you are actively doing lunar science. You have a payload heading to the moon soon. How does some of the data that you're getting back from Artemis 2 help you in preparing for that mission? Do you know more about where you're going now?
So the trajectory they took, they would have been able to see the landing site for the Gruithuisen domes, which is where we're going to go with LunarVise in, knock on wood, 2028. So we potentially will get some data from that. It was not one of their targets of opportunity. So I don't know if they particularly got anything good there. But just the way they did the observations and thinking about how they flew over and some of the trajectories that we might be on our initial flybys on our mission, sort of the impetus that's coming out of this mission, I do think will be really impactful going forward for the upcoming CLIPS missions. So for the robotic missions that'll be going alongside these human missions. I think too, thinking about some of the viewing angles and some of the way they described what they were able to see at different times on the surface. That's really interesting to think about when we're thinking about our operations. We're primarily a lander and a rover, but we do plan to take some observations as we're orbiting the moon before we land, and then we're taking images as we descend. Thinking about viewing angles and how close you are, how far you are, and all of that, it was really interesting to be thinking about that while they were making their observations as they got closer to the moon.
Mm-hmm. And does it make you any more excited with your mission now that you're seeing these images like this?
I mean, it's hard to get that much more excited than I sort of baseline am about LunarVise. But yes, it 100% did. I don't know. I've just been like buzzing all day today and texting with all these people that are in the community. And we've been talking about doing this for years, right?
Paul, I'm going to end with you here. I was speaking to a planetary scientist throughout the week during this Artemis 2 mission, and he told me, this is surely going to bring us more questions than answers when it comes to the moon, which is not a bad thing when it comes to science. I know it's early, but what questions now do we have of the moon now that we have this brand new perspective of it?
Yeah. Well, because so the first thing that comes to mind is, what is the actual impact flux at the moon? What is the rate at which stuff hits it based on these observations that the crew observed yesterday with these impact flashes? And that is a bunch of important reasons, because one, it'll tell us about what the number of things out there generally that might hit us is as well, right? So there's a planetary defense component to it. There's a science component there, because I'm on an instrument called LEMS, which is nominally going to be deployed by the first landed mission, which is probably Natomi Artemis 4. And LEMS is essentially a seismometer that the astronauts will place there. And we hope it'll last for about 2 years or perhaps even longer. One of the things we need for a seismometer is some sort of active source of seismic energy. Impacts give us this. And of course, if we are seriously going to be putting a base on the moon and having astronauts live on the moon long term, we need to know what kind of space hazards they face, including things like stuff hitting the ground. So that observation alone has already advanced us. And I don't have the imagination, and I like to think I'm pretty imaginative, to think of what future questions we're going to have, but I cannot wait to get to the point where we can ask them.
Mm-hmm. And that, again, was by chance, right? That they never would have seen that if it wasn't for the eclipse.
If it wasn't for that launch window, yep.
Wow. Paul Byrne, Addie Dove, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Still to come, a look at NASA's possible new budget.
This proposal is treated as the baseline of what NASA will do starting in October 1st, 2026, which is the beginning of the 27th fiscal year. So it has a lot of detail and consequence for that. It sets planning. It sets, again, the terms of the debate among Congress. And it initiates programs, proposes to cancel programs, you name it, at a very high level of detail.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You are listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media, I'm Brendan Byrne. For decades, scientists have been trying to answer the question, could there be life on one of Earth's neighboring planets? Rovers on Mars are now one step closer to answering that question. We'll dive into this latest discovery from the Red Planet. That's later this month on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about NASA and the planned budget for the next fiscal year. The Trump administration is proposing a 23% budget cut to the agency, which would cut things that were deemed, quote, low-priority missions. But Artemis would receive over $8 billion. Here to talk more about the budget and future of NASA science is Casey Dreyer, the Chief of Policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having me.
Casey, we invited you on here to talk about the budget, but before we do that, I want to talk about, what happened this week with the Artemis 2 mission. What was your reaction to finally seeing this mission leave the ground and fly around the moon like it has?
I mean, some form of disbelief, I think, but not for any political reason. I mean, my policy brain and logic brain, all that turns off. You know, I was a kid that used to draw the Apollo capsule, you know, and Voyager. And that was my doodles when I was, 5 years old. My first drawing, my parents say, was of a rocket when I was 3. And they didn't know how I knew that word. Seeing humans lift off to go to the moon was something that I had grown up with, but as almost as myth, as something that had happened in history that we didn't do anymore. And to be able to witness it it's hard to express the feeling of seeing that shift from myth into reality.
Do you envision yourself doodling the Orion space capsule now?
I guess it'd be kind of a squatter looking thing. And I guess it's got solar panels. It doesn't quite have that Apollo command module, the whole getup. It's just such a sleek, beautifully proportioned system. Orion is kind of a strange little mishmash of things. It doesn't quite have the same lines. Maybe my daughter will start drawing those four little panels as she watches in her life growing up in the shadow of ongoing lunar exploration.
What a wonderful a thought to have there. Casey, let's turn to this budget proposal. But before we get into the discussion, just give us our civics 101 here. How does the budget happen and why do these proposals matter to the process?
So ultimately, Congress has control of disbursements from the Treasury. And that's in the Constitution. But the entire process begins with the president's budget request, which functionally sets out the terms of the debate. And so every year, by law, the White House is supposed to release a full budget proposal for the United States government. Usually comes out in the early spring. The budget proposal is a proposal, but what it represents is official administration policy. And so until Congress, and particularly with this presidential administration, until Congress specifically enacts something counter to this proposal is treated as the baseline of what NASA will do starting in October 1st, 2026, which is the beginning of the 27th fiscal year. So it has a lot of detail and consequence for that. It sets planning. It sets, again, the terms of the debate among Congress. And it initiates programs, proposes to cancel programs, you name it, at a very high level of detail.
You foreshadowed your feelings to this budget proposal earlier in our conversation, but the Planetary Society put out a statement that says it is, quote, deeply disappointed. Why is that, Casey?
Well, we went through a similar process last year where the White House proposed the steepest cut to NASA in its history. It proposed to cut NASA science in half. It was resoundingly rejected by Congress. And that wasn't a surprise. Congress ultimately didn't happen until January, but Congress had signaled its intent. It's a Republican-controlled Congress, right, of the president's own party in the summer. So it was clearly coming. They put forward a proposal that was basically copied and pasted from last year. And I'm not exaggerating. There are references to missions that no longer exist because they were canceled that they referenced last year. There are several areas where they actually accidentally request funding for 2026 instead of 2027. This is a sloppy proposal, but also, again, literally the same, as if nothing had happened between their proposal last year and this year. So it calls for the same egregious levels of cuts to NASA science, cuts it in half. It calls for cutting NASA by the second largest amount ever proposed, the first being last year. And it's only smaller because NASA got a little less money this year than it did last year. And to do that, I thought during Artemis II, while the astronauts were going around the moon for the first time in 54 years, to then propose undermining and dismantling the very agency that is tasked with their safety and the success of this mission was also just, to me, beyond poor taste.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? From Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Casey Dreyer. He is the Chief of Space Policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, you said this was a copy-paste to last year. Can you give me a number of how much money it actually cuts to in comparison to what NASA is getting now?
It would cut almost $6 billion from NASA's $24.8 billion.
That's a substantial chunk, right?
25, yeah, roughly a quarter of the entire agency. And then it proposes to cut $3.4 billion from NASA science, which is roughly 47%, basically to bring it down to what they proposed last year. So these are, you know, draconian cuts. These are not efficiency. You don't get efficiency by slaughtering something, you know, and breaking it in two. This is not about reasonable political or policy perspectives because Congress so resoundingly rejected these. Again, Congress of the president's own party. They are likely to again, but in that interim, it creates pointless, needless uncertainty. It directs NASA to plan for these awful cuts, and so it can't plan for the future. It is distracted from executing the program of record, and it just burns all this time. It's inefficient almost by design, ironically, given the stated goals of this administration. So it is a wasteful exercise, but a serious one regardless.
You mentioned the timing of this is certainly interesting. So let's talk about Artemis. How did Artemis program at large fare in this proposal? We saw today, we're taping this on Tuesday, you know, the White House is touting some of the images that have come back. The president spoke with the crew on Monday while heading back from the moon. It seems like there is a focus on Artemis by this administration. Does this budget proposal reflect that?
It's the one thing that is not explicitly dismantled, but it's less positive than it sounds. So they technically request a slight increase, but because there's this additional pot of money that Congress funded last year independently, you know, as an outside source from just appropriations, if you add the two together and what they plan to spend, it basically stays flat. Now, that's great for Artemis. That's great for deep space exploration. But the rest of NASA suffers. And in addition to this, they also propose to further reduce NASA's civil servant headcount down to 11,000 people. Right now, it's roughly at 14,000 after losing 20%, the largest reductions in NASA history. NASA currently has its smallest workforce since 1960, right before Apollo happened. This proposes further cuts. There's no way to separate the consequences from the rest of the agency from Artemis, as if those are easily distinguished. This is an attack on the entire agency. It's going to undermine the entire agency. It's going to undermine the science return you get from this effort. And it creates this political instability for carrying Artemis forward, right? I mean, Artemis should continue beyond this administration. But if you build Artemis on the backs of all these other projects that are popular among various other constituencies, Artemis itself will have a target. It'll be seen fairly or not as being the cause of the destruction of all these other things. And so if other administration, a Democratic administration, wants to build back science or earth science or technology or STEM education, which is completely zeroed out in this budget, Artemis will be seen as a target for that. So just for the long-term success of Artemis, you want a healthy rest of NASA to not engender this kind of political divide and partisanship getting injected into this. And that's the long-term danger here too.
It also seems like it undermines directly what NASA Administrator Jared Isaacman is calling for, right? He's got this plan to increase the cadence of Artemis launches. And one of the things that he said he was going to do to make that happen was increase the civil servants, right? And this budget cuts it. How does that square up?
There's a lot of questions raised by this budget because a lot of what we heard at the NASA Ignition event a few weeks ago are just fundamentally incompatible, if not outright contravened by what this proposal says. Another example of that is commercial low Earth orbit space stations, where NASA a couple of weeks ago was saying the current plan will not work. We don't have any confidence in this. Instead, we want to build attachments to the ISS and keep running it longer. This budget says, nope, we're building two free-flying commercial stations. We're deorbiting the ISS in 2030. These are fundamentally incompatible statements. One is an official statement of policy. The other one is what NASA administrators said 2 weeks ago. So which one is true? Another example, they highlighted during the NASA Ignition event, the collaboration between NASA and the European Space Agency on the Rosalind Franklin rover, Europe's first Mars rover. NASA is going to be launching that mission. It'll be helping them land. It will be providing, it's carrying a very big and expensive instrument that NASA developed 10 years ago. This budget cancels Rosalind Franklin. Why were they saying we're going to continue? NASA had just sent a letter to ESA back in November saying that they have recommitted to that mission after the administration tried to cancel it last year. Is it canceled? It certainly seems like that in the formal request, but it's not even clear. So there are dozens more examples like that where what NASA is saying it was going to do is completely different than the official request that came out last week.
Finally, Casey, you mentioned this is a proposal, right? It's in the hands of Congress to appropriate the budget and give the money to NASA. Last time we had this proposal, Congress, quote unquote, saved the agency, and was able to get them more money. Is that going to be the case this year? And I only ask that because it is a different time politically, right? We're going into the midterms, and that may be some political capital that some people will not want to spend, right?
It's possible, and that's certainly the disruptive element. If nothing else, it'll almost guarantee that no budget appropriations will happen before the midterm elections in November.
And what happens then?
Likely a continuing resolution, because they also don't want to have a shutdown. The White House won't want to have a shutdown leading into the elections, but it adds a chaotic element. And then when you come back to the lame duck session of Congress after that, depending on the results of the election, there may not be much appetite to pass appropriations, because maybe there's more advantage into waiting into the next congressional session when the majorities are different, or maybe there's to do it now. And it really throws things out. Now, the positive thing, though, is that because NASA still, despite my warnings, is not a partisan agency, space science is not seen as partisan. We had a huge,
Casey Dreyer is the chief of policy at the Planetary Society. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at AWTY Space. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at arewethereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.